Welcome back, dear listener, to the Codex Radio Podcast. As always, I am your host, Endless Odyssey. This is episode 2 and part 2 of our first season, wherein we're reading through the Prima Strategy Guide for Riven, the sequel to Myst. I don't have many announcements to waste your time with today, so we'll get into the reading very quickly, but I did just want to mention that I plan to put this episode out on a Friday. Right now the plan is to definitely stick to a schedule of posting a new episode every Wednesday, but I also wanted to start the podcast off at a slightly faster pace than that. So you may be getting more frequent episodes for at least a little while, you know, until I feel like we've kind of hit our stride. If there is a bonus episode to be put out during any given week, it'll be released on a Friday, so hopefully that'll give you a nice little surprise and maybe something to look forward to going into your weekend. I hope you enjoyed part one. There was a bit of table setting with a fairly long excerpt from Atrus' in-game journal, where we learned about his father, Gen, and Atrus' scheme to save Riven while putting in some contingencies to prevent Gen from escaping the age that he is apparently imprisoned in. Today we'll start getting more into the puzzle sequences of Riven, and I think it'll be interesting to see how the author's description of those puzzles will actually translate for you if you're unfamiliar with the game. We last left the stranger outside of the temple on Temple Island. He had just inadvertently summoned the tram from the next island and had worked out how to rotate it in order to ride it back across the water. We ended right before he turned on the engine and made that journey. So, without further ado, I give you part 2 of the Prima Strategy Guide to Riven by Rick Barba. Jungle Island. Interesting trip. I'd tell you more, but I need to go find my stomach now. I'm pretty sure I dropped it somewhere near the tram's third curve. Did I tell you I hate roller coasters? Perhaps I should have. Then this craven fear might be less surprising. Well, I survived anyway. After the spasm subsided, I stepped from the tram car. Heading for the stairs in a nearby cave passage, I glimpsed something odd. A big wooden eye in the rock wall. When I touched it, the eye rotated. An odd symbol is etched on the back. And the eye makes odd noises. It chirps. But wait, it gets weirder. I tried to extract the eye. Nothing doing, so I turned away, entering the cave passage. I climbed the stairs, and halfway up I turned to get a last look at the eye. That's a frog, if I ever saw one. Note the location of the wooden eye in the shape of the cave opening. There's no way that's a coincidence. Surely it means something. Anyway, I climbed the stairs and sat down to write this. Another blue tram call button is installed here. Outside, stone stairs lead up and down. Which way? I think I'll start low. Sun or rock? Wildlife! Descending the steep stairway, I came upon quite a sight. Two incredible animals lay on rocks in a gorgeous aquamarine lagoon. One raised its head. I froze, which was good, because as I discovered later, they spook easily. I inched forward, moving only when their heads were lowered. These sunners, as I'll call them, look like seals with long necks and huge snouts. The snout is remarkable. I'm no marine biologist, but their jaws appear lined with baleen, thin, bony plates that strain food from the water like some whales have. When I stepped onto the beach, one of the sunners raised its head again and barked. Quite a sound. When I turned to stroll down the beach, both slipped into the water and disappeared. I rounded the lagoon. It was beautiful. The water crystal clear. Too bad restless tectonic plates are ripping the place apart. At the end of the beach, I sat down to write and look for more sunners, but then I saw something lodged in the rocks out in the lagoon. Another wooden eye. Remembering the frog outline of the cave opening, I squinted at the rock formation. After a moment, I saw it, the same whale-like, humpbacked creature I saw back in Gen's temple. I waded across a sandbar to the eye and rotated it. The sound was indeed cetaceous, but with a chilling edge. And I found another symbol etched on the backside. Animals and sound shapes paired with odd symbols. What's the correlation? Village Lake. Weird physics reigns in Riven. From the lagoon, I returned to the path and followed it through a long, twisting tunnel. Fortunately, tiny globe lanterns lit the way. As I emerged onto a catwalk, a native sentry sounded an alarm and signaled below. I crept forward, expecting a volley of arrows, but the sentry disappeared. I could see no signs of life. And then I saw the lake. At first glance, it was just that, a lake, surrounded by the high cliff walls of an ancient crumbling crater. It was as translucent and beautiful as the Sunner's Lagoon. But then I looked closer. The lake had holes. Holes in the water. I scrambled down ladders to the lake surface. A path led to a ladder that dropped down into a quivering water hole. Incredible. At the bottom, I noticed the twin rails of a track. An underwater track circuit rings from the lake from hole to hole. Looks like another tram system. The holes must be tram stops. Stunning. I sit on the platform above the tracks, writing these journal notes and fighting the urge to thrust my arm through the shimmering vertical wall. After a rest, I climbed back up to a small rock plateau. As I nearly passed the crude earthen basin, yet another wooden eye caught my attention. Embedded in the basin, this eye makes a rubbing, clicking sound when rotated. Remembering the other eyes, I tried viewing it from a different perspective, looking for the distinctive outline of another creature, but nothing looked familiar. Thirsty, I gave the basin spigot a twist. Water bubbled up around the wooden eye and then stopped abruptly. I tried the spigot again. Nothing. I looked at the water. An image began to coalesce in a strange Rorschach sort of way. Call me nutty, but it looks like a bug. From the basin plateau, I saw a number of interesting structures on the cliff surrounding the lake. I climbed back up to the path and retraced my route all the way back past Sunner's Lagoon. From there, I headed back up to the stone steps. The Jungle Gate. The path led over a suspension bridge to a clear-cut area. Great tree stumps covered the hillside. I remembered the odd religious icons depicted back in the Temple Island Gate Room. In one, trees were felled to make sacred books. Linking books, perhaps? If Gen is trapped here, he's surely seeking a way out. Up ahead, I saw a gate, and behind it, a dense forest. Before entering, I veered off a side path and found a small cart on an underground track. Given the setting, I assume it's a logging car used to transport felled timber to some other location, perhaps another island. I turned and approached the gate. There, a chance encounter confirmed an earlier observation. A large beetle was crawling up the gatepost. As I snapped a quick photo, it spread its wings to fly. I recognized the wingspread. It was the golden scarab on the pillars in the gate room. As it flew away, the bug buzzed. Yes, the same rubbing sound emitted by the wooden eye in the water basin. So the shape formed by the basin's water was a bug after all. So far, then, three wooden eyes clearly match up with three Riven Age creatures. Given the preoccupation with fives around here, my guess is that two more wooden eyes exist somewhere. Of course, I still have no clue what it all means. My mission is to find Gen and trap him, but maybe on Riven, all eyes look to Gen. Giant Dagger. This forest is spectacular. The trees are massive, old-growth beauties, and a phosphorescent blue fungus grows wild in the deep shade. The path runs directly under a rumbling, rotating dome. Nearby juts another giant dagger, where rough-hewn steps descend into a hole in the forest floor. And there? Another wooden eye. I could find no animal silhouette, but when I rotated the eye, the sound was unmistakable, a sunner bark. Eye number four clearly matches the lagoon creature. After my discovery, I returned to the path, happy in the knowledge that I'm cleverly piecing together clues for no apparent purpose. Tusk Whale Idol. Under the rumbling spinning dome, I hit a fork in the path. Being right-handed, I went right, down a lane to yet another carved likeness of the humpbacked tusk whale. This creature is clearly a powerful cultural icon in Riven. An upper walkway ran to the top of this particular idol. I found a power switch atop a nearby post, and the idol's mouth dropped open, an eerie, tooth-lined staircase. Inside, I found a tram call button and an elevator. A quick trip down revealed the tram station, but I wasn't ready to leave the island yet, so I rode up to the top where a sturdy metal catwalk wound through the treetops. Shades of channel wood. Rotating dome. The dome lay just ahead. At a fork in the catwalk, I went left and examined the spinning structure. A sequence of circular symbols ringed the dome, and one, I noted, was highlighted yellow. The other fork of the catwalk ended at a small device that looked like a viewfinder. I looked in the eyepiece. A kinetoscope. The shuttered viewer focused on the rotating dome symbols, creating an illusion of motion, and a button atop the scope did nothing, it seemed, until I hit it precisely when the yellow symbol appeared. The dome stopped spinning and slid open. What now? I hurried to the dome. Through a glass window in the open slot, I could see a book. Under the window, a scale with 5 sliders and a button. Looks like I need a 5-number code. What sort of book would be in such a well-protected place? I had a pretty good idea. But if it's a linking book, where does it link to? The Watchtower. Okay, I'm sitting on another throne. A throne with a view. Truly, one could feel like a god up here. I can see everything. Here's how I got here. From the dome, I continued up the path to a small tower on a cliff overlooking the lake. Inside the tower, a chair nestled snugly in the bleached jawbone of a tusked whale. So these aquatic creatures aren't mythical. I guess I won't be doing any body surfing. I sat and pushed a lever. The chair began to rotate and rise. Gen's Watchtower? What a view. I can see a cluster of spherical huts on the far cliff. Directly below is a strange cone-shaped cage. Its base platform was open at first, but I pushed the chair's right-hand lever and it slid shut. A narrow plank connects a smaller platform at the top of the cage to a catwalk running along a nearby cliff wall. What is this thing? It looks ceremonial. I must reach that village somehow. Perhaps the natives can lead me to Gen. The village. I'm an object of fear. Hilarious as that seems, it's got me stymied. People are running from me. No one will talk. To get here, I retraced my route to the Tusk Whale elevator and rode down. As I moved through the forest, I encountered a small girl. She ran, but I managed to snap a photo. Under the dome, I tried the other fork, veering right. Stairs spanned a thundering volcanic fissure. I wondered if this might be the star fissure, the rift I'm supposed to exploit, but it didn't make sense. A crevice of molten lava? I continued up through another wooden gate, then followed the path down a blue-lit, eerie cave passage. Halfway down, I came upon a primitive cave painting. Its implications were unsettling. Almighty Riven God feeds folks to the fish? My approach triggered a flurry of activity in the village. People ran, gathered up children, and so on. By the time I got there, every hut was sealed, not a soul out. I climbed to a rock ledge. It held a kiln and several ceremonial urns. Most interesting, however, was the wheeled iron sphere. Clearly, it rides those underwater rails on the lake bed. I gave the nearby handle a yank. A hoist lowered the sub into a waterhole below, and looking down, I recognized the access dock. It was the hole just past the bug-eye basin where I'd been earlier. Submarine circuit. Ahoy! Okay, so maybe I'm not exactly 20,000 leagues under the sea, but how many people can say they've captained a submarine? It was a long trek back around the island, but I found a bit of a shortcut. After following the catwalks back to the wooden gate, I continued past it. Stairs led directly up to the clear-cut area of the forest, and from there it was easy to work my way back past the lagoon and the bug basin to the dock ladder. I climbed into the submarine and experimented with the controls. Then I took the helm, so to speak. My first turns around the lake were fun but frustrating. Because the ramps were retracted, I could exit the sub at only one other dock. There I had to climb iron rungs up a sheer cliff face into a tower at the top. I found 5 levers set in the wall, 2 up, 3 down. I pushed up the middle lever and turned to a view slot overlooking the lake. I'd extended the dock access ramp of the cone-shaped cage platform. 5 levers, 5 docks, 5 access ramps. Realizing the up position extends the ramp, I flipped up all 5 levers. And then it was back to Das Boot for further undersea adventures. Schoolroom. The more I learn of Gen, the creepier he seems. My next stop on the sub-circuit was a small hut. A school, clearly. Benches and rows filled a single room inside. Strange writing covered the crude chalkboards on the front wall. An alphabet lines the side walls. A globe-like cage with a crank handle turns out to be a hologram projector. Could this be Gen? I gave the handle a turn, and a talking head had appeared and intoned a formal greeting. The only word I recognized was Denis. The head resembled the figures in the gate room religious icons, and I knew this was Gen. Okay, that was bad enough, but then I found a gruesome Rivenese counting game. 2 stick figures hang upside down from what are clearly a pair of gallows. At the base is an open-mouthed tusk whale. To play, you rotate the deadly jaws under one victim and then the other. Each rotation displays a random symbol on the front of the base. When the symbol appears, the current victim lowers a few notches toward the tusk whale. It seems obvious that each symbol represents a number, and they look familiar. Yes, the symbols on the back of the wooden eyes. Having read in Atrus's journal of Gen's myopic mission to restore Denis civilization, my guess is that these are Denis numbers. Of course, a device like this teaches children numbers and a whole lot more. My guess is this. The numbers on the backs of the wooden eyes create an order. Bug is 2, frog is 3, sunner is 4, and the tusk whale is 5. The numerical order arranges the creatures from smallest to biggest, but I haven't yet found the wooden eye that correlates to 1, the first in the series. And even if I do, what will it tell me? Amazing, I've learned so much, and yet I know so little. Gallows. And now, I sit atop the tall, cone-shaped cage structure, the final destination in the submarine circuit. What I found here turns my stomach, and adds a note of urgency and caution to my search for Gen. Emerging from the sub, I stepped to the cage platform. Suddenly I heard a chilling wail. It was the sound I'd heard when rotating the wooden eye on the tusk whale rock formation in the lagoon. Only this was real, and loud, and nearby. Stepped away from the water. I noticed a small handle hanging from a cable. When I gave it a yank, a metal bar dropped from the upper platform. I quickly straddled the bar and rowed it back up to the top. As I hopped off, I noticed a pair of adjustable clamps on either end of the bar, and an image of the schoolroom hangman game flashed in my mind. Then its purpose, the purpose of this entire structure, hit me full force. These clamps are leg irons. This is a gallows. I tried to imagine it. Legs clamped tight, dangling upside down. Below, the platform opens, the water roils furiously, and down you go. I shook the image from my head and hurried across a plank to the catwalk. There, a cell in the cliffside housed a prisoner. Did he know his fate? Of course he did. Clearly, Gen has chosen to make this a form of punishment as a grisly public spectacle. Just down the catwalk, I found a control wheel. A few quick turns opened the cell, but the prisoner didn't emerge. Was his spirit broken? I went to the cell. He was gone. Now I sit here on the gallows. Guards in white coats may descend at any moment. I'll end up whale food, but thus far, not a soul in sight anywhere. Next step, scour the holding cell for clues to the prisoner's disappearance. Holding cell. Gen's enemies are well organized. I found a remarkable secret exit from the cell. Wasn't hard to find, actually. I mean, not many places to look in a bare cell. I gave the ring mechanism in the grate a pull and watched as a section of the back wall pulled away. When I stepped through, the passage closed behind me. The tunnel beyond was pitch black, but I gathered up my courage and groped forward along the walls. Soon I came to an opening that dropped to the sea. A small light globe cast light up the tunnel. I turned back and groped for more such globes. Working my way from globe to globe, I reached a door carved into the cave wall. I pulled the handle. The door swung open across the tunnel, revealing a new passage. Stone pillar room. So it comes to this. A guy sits in a cavernous room playing with pillars. Here's where I ended up. 25 pillars, each etched with a creature icon, are arrayed in a circle around this cavern. Some of the creatures look familiar. Sunner, frog, tusk whale, bug. When I push an icon, that pillar lowers. I suppose there must be a code, but what is it, and what does it activate? Time to get off this island. Maybe a new setting will freshen my thinking. Logging car. Of course, island hopping can be a white-knuckle experience. Recalling the tram ride from Temple Island, I opted to take the logging car. Surely a cart carrying lumber would move at a nice, leisurely pace. So I worked my way back up the secret tunnel. Outside the holding cell, I turned right and followed the catwalk to a ladder I extended to the lower catwalk. From there, I worked my way back to the clear-cut area. And now here I sit, in a lumber cart, bringing this journal up to date. Lumber from this island probably goes to wherever Gen makes paper, and hence his books. I may find him at the other end of this track. In any case, I'm ready to pull the lever and trundle slowly to wherever I end up. Book Assembly Island. Whoever designed Riven's inter-island transportation systems need a better grasp of G-Force. Halfway through the water tube ride on the logging car, I felt my cheeks pulling away from my gums. I saw quantum physics. It's not just a theory, man. And then I got dumped into a wood chipper. Boy, I'm glad it was turned off. Those things weren't made for people, you know. Soft tissue really gums up the gears. Anyway, this chipper sits on the bank of an ancient crater lake. The water's turquoise opacity suggests great depth. Several other structures squat nearby. This is Riven's publishing center. Logs roll in, get churned into piles of sawdust, boiled into pulp, and pressed into pages. I recognize the machines of the process as depicted in the gate room icon. I also see a balcony high on the cliffside with a pair of doors. Beyond that, a catwalk runs along the precipice, but I can spot only two ways up the cliff, a long ladder under the balcony and a massive boiler pipe that curls up the cliff like a giant snake. Unfortunately, the ladder ends at a locked hatch on the balcony's underside, so I'll focus my attention on the boiler. The boiler controls, of course, didn't work, but I'm learning the ways of Riven. Remembering the power technology I'd seen on Temple Island, I looked for a steam pipe. Sure enough, I'd found one running out to a central valve in the middle of the lake. The valve regulates power to three locations, the boiler, the wood chipper, and some unseen device in the nearby cliff. I turned the valve to the boiler setting. This thing is no tea kettle. It's a massive tank with a solid brick housing. After much experimentation, I learned how to get inside the boiler pipe. It's a three-part process. Turn off the furnace, drain the tank, raise the floor grate. The last step required a simple reroute of steam power using the valve switch just left of the boiler controls. Once inside the pipe, I found the going slow and dark. I finally emerged and dropped to a worn path overlooking the ocean. As I climbed the path, I could just glimpse the roof of a spectacular building nestled behind the jagged clifftop to the right. The path ended at the high balcony that I'd seen from the beach, and there on the balcony's floor was the hatch that had blocked access from the ladder below. I unlatched it. Now I have a quick route down to the lake. I turned to face the double doors off the balcony, and I wondered, would these lead me to Gen? The answer, no. But they did lead me to frogs. That's right, frogs. A twisting metal walkway beyond the doors led to an odd contraption under a humming ventilation fan. The device was simple enough to operate once I got it powered up. This required a trip back to the steam pipe valve in the middle of the lake. At first, I admit it, I was stumped. I opened the top and put a food pellet in the center disc. Then I pulled a handle to lower the device into unseen depths. Nothing happened. What the hell is this thing? I examined the fan overhead, wondering what it might be ventilating. I sat down, took a rest, and suddenly I heard a snap far below. I yanked the handle to pull up the trap, and I opened it to see a reddish frog. It chirped and hopped away. It was the same chirp I'd heard when I rotated the first wooden eye near the frog-shaped cave. Footbridge. Gen's a tricky one. I spent much fruitless time looking for a route from the balcony frog trap area to the cliff catwalk that leads to the hidden building. In and out of the balcony, in and out, nothing. Finally, in disgust, I slammed the balcony entry doors from the inside. And there was the answer. Concealed behind the open double doors had been a pair of passages, one on either side. Closing the doors revealed these secret entries. The one to the right led directly to the hidden building. On the way, I found a lever, which I pulled, of course. My personal motto, be intrusive. I heard a mechanism deactivate. What? Noting the power cable running from the lever in two directions, back to the balcony and forward to the hidden building, I moved on. The hidden building was locked, so I continued forward through a short tunnel. When I emerged, I trudged on across the bridge. At the far end, I came to the drawbridge I'd seen from below on Temple Island. I lowered it and entered the Golden Dome. I followed the catwalk around the curve to the end, and there I turned a wheel to extend the retracted section of the catwalk. Easy enough. As I crossed the newly extended catwalk, I glanced left out a side door. A section of the walk was missing. But I continued down the stairs, out past the steam pipe that powered the drawbridge, and onto the tunnel entrance. There, I noticed a power button on the wall. When I pushed it, nothing happened. I looked up to see that the catwalk with the missing section was directly above me. And then I looked down. Aha! A section of the walkway at my feet connected to a pair of grooves running up the side of the wall, right to the gap in the upper catwalk. But how do I raise this section? I hustled upstairs to the gap. I looked down, and then I turned back to the dome. There, next to the doorway, was a button. I pushed it, and the missing section ascended into place, bridging the gap. Since I was up there anyway, I crossed the new section and followed the catwalk, which passed over another rotating dome. It led to a door that opened with a simple pull of a switch. I entered and found myself just outside the gate room. I recognized the place. This was the locked door outside the rightmost of the two gated passages from the gate room, and now it was open. Rotating dome. This seems like an awful lot of busy work. It better pay off, or I'll file complaints. I went all the way back down to the lower catwalk, past the steam pipe again, to the button on the wall. Because the missing section of the catwalk was now raised, the button was active. I pushed it, and a hydraulic lift lowered me to a tunnel below. I followed this out to a stairway that climbed to the rotating dome. I used the kinetoscope as before. As the dome opened, I noticed one of the large power pipes from the Golden Dome fed directly into it. My guess, the other four pipes lead to rotating domes on other islands. Again, the Golden Dome seems to be a central power source for these rotating domes. I decided to head back to Book Assembly Island, as I'm calling it for obvious reasons, but I made one quick detour on the way. I rounded the catwalk inside the Golden Dome, and I stopped to raise the bridge to the gate room. This time, I'll leave it up. This clearly connects the gate room to a higher level in the Golden Dome. Maybe I can find another way into the gate room so I can access whatever lies above. A rotating dome, Book Assembly Island. I found another rotating dome. But this time, I see no way to stop the spinning. Where's the kinetoscope? Wait, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me bring you up to date. From the Golden Dome, I trek back across the long inter-island footbridge, past the hidden building, which I'm convinced holds answers, and back to the spot just inside the double doors of the balcony. I'd almost forgotten that another passage runs down the opposite side. So I followed it to another rotating dome. But this one had no kinetoscope. How could I stop the rotation? First, I looked up. The dome sits in a cavern. The power pipe from the Golden Dome curls in through a round hole blasted in the ceiling. Book Assembly Rotating Dome is underground. Only this crater hole in the ceiling would give away its location from above. Then I walked around the dome, trying to determine the highlighted symbol. These circular symbols, one associated with each dome so far, must signify something. And then I caught sight of a lens embedded in the rock wall. Could that be the kinetoscope viewfinder? If so, how do I reach it? Patterns. That's the key. Designers of ages rarely do things just once, I've learned. Not again, anyway. So, when I sat by the spinning dome, staring at the lens in the rock, stumped after hours of exploring every nook and cranny of the area, I thought back on other secret routes I'd uncovered on these islands. Most recently, I'd found two simply by closing the balcony doors. Of course, I went back to the single door I'd opened to enter the dome chamber. Closing it revealed yet another secret passage. This one led directly to the hidden kinetoscope. Back at the open dome, I found what I expected, another book sealed below in a chamber, and another slider scale lock. I'm convinced these domes harbor linking books, but links to where? I know I've asked this question before, but I'm getting no answers. A lot of puzzle pieces are in place, but I see no big picture yet. Where's Atris when I need him? Is there anything that can shed light on this age? Gen's Laboratory. My mother used to say, "Ask and you shall receive." Of course, that never worked with stuff I really wanted, but here in Riven I've finally gotten some answers. Ironically, they're courtesy of Gen. Before I continue my chronicle, let me list some important things I now know or strongly suspect. 1. I believe the star fissure lies under the big telescope back on Temple Island. 2. Gen has managed to create a link to another age, where he resides and works now. 3. The rotating domes are called fire marbles. They power and, as I suspected, protect the linking books to Gen's new age. 4. I found the 5-number slider code that opens these domes. 5. That hidden building along the cliff walkway is actually Gen's laboratory. 6. Gen has enemies. A rebel group called the Moiety, led by Catherine, wife of Atris. Those distinctive daggers are their calling card. The plot thickens. How do I know all this? Read on. I climbed the stairs from the fire marble cavern. At the balcony's double doors, I realized something was missing, a sound I'd heard earlier. This drew me back down to Gen's frog catcher. It was quieter. I looked up. The ventilation fan was off. I remembered the lever back on the path near Gen's lab. One end of its power cable ran here, and the other to Gen's lab. Perhaps the fan ventilated the lab? Too perfect. Couldn't be. But I climbed up through the fan housing into the ventilation duct and crawled to the other end. And here's where I ended up. Gen's lab. This 5-sided workshop is where Gen has been trying to recreate the Dene art of assembling and writing linking books. Arrayed neatly on work tables, inks, paper, a page press, a bookbinder, blank books. Before I discuss the contents of Gen's journal, let me point out one other important discovery. On his desk, I found the 5th wooden eye, the one with the Dene number 1 on its back. I still don't know what the creature associated with it is, because it emits no sound, and Gen plucked it and brought it here. But a nearby note suggests I can see its location through a scope in what Gen calls his survey room. Gen's lab journal. 82.2.13. The latest ink formulation has proven a failure. Even when writing in my most promising books, I obtain only the barest glimmer of a connection. It is frustrating to expend so much effort creating a blank book, only to end up destroying it when it doesn't work. There are days when the lab is uncomfortably warm from the flames of these failed attempts. The further I refine each element, the formulations of the ink and papers, the physical dimensions of the book, the more I realize that the list of potential combinations is nearly infinite. It is during moments like these that I despair. Without access to Denis, my long-term goals may never be accomplished. Nevertheless, there are avenues of research which remain to be explored. 82.5.8. I'm discontinuing regular observations of the stars beneath the fissure. Although I've been able to track the dark cloud-like formations that migrate through the star field and have proven that their paths are cyclical, without proper instrumentation, it's pointless to continue. My general theory concerning the nature of the fissure has remained unaltered since it first appeared. It seems that the fabric of this age has been breached in a way that permits matter to be hospitably exchanged between two discrete but overlapping spaces. Much like a link, but the apparent physical contradictions surrounding this juncture defy logical reason. The great column of wind that was formed when the fissure first appeared suggests a vacuum, as one might expect in space, yet my early experimentations reveal the presence of a breathable atmosphere. That Atrus and Catherine threw themselves into the void is further evidence that it might be safe to travel, but without knowing its true nature, I cannot take the risk myself. It's also difficult to say what would happen if I were to reopen it after so long, but it is likely that the results would be catastrophic, given that the changes have occurred in this age since that time. 83.2.10. Maintenance on the steam vent caps completed. I am extremely pleased with the continued success of this system. I believe the construction to have been true to the Denis designs of my memory, another example of the superiority of the Denis technology. It's ironic that Atrus and Catherine unwittingly provided me with such a convenient source of power. As with many of my views over the years, my thoughts regarding the origin of the fissure have changed. I have recently begun to wonder whether it was actually an unexpected byproduct of the changes Catherine and Atrus wrote into this age during their escape. Certainly by casting their linking book into the void, they trapped me here quite effectively, but I do not believe that Atrus intended the book to be lost in this manner. Much better to destroy it than risk the possibility of it falling into unknown hands. Also, had they foreseen the creation of the fissure, they surely would have thought that the vacuum it created would eventually consume the atmosphere of this planet, a fate which Catherine undoubtedly would have deemed unacceptable for her home world. If I had not been there to supervise the construction of the seal, this is most certainly what would have happened, for the villagers were far too frightened to even approach the vortex without my urging. I hold on to the belief that it was an unintended consequence of their writing, for another reason as well. I prefer to think that my son had meant for this age to be merely a prison for me, rather than a death sentence. 83.5.14. The construction of the imagers has proceeded without fault. It is interesting to see how easily I've been able to adapt the Denis technology to mimic that of the Ahmad. In some ways, the similarities between the two cultures was striking. I wonder if perhaps there had been communication or commerce between the two cultures in earlier times. Maybe Keta's people were even descendants of the Denis. It pleases me to think so. It's possible that if I were somehow able to supply the books with a power source of sufficient magnitude, I could suppress the variance long enough to facilitate a solid link. It is doubtful that the geothermal cap generators could provide such an enormous surge. Perhaps I could adapt the fire marbles. I've been cataloging the natural elements of this age for nearly 30 years now, yet I still continue to find evidence of the Denise preoccupation with 5. As a boy, it was very clear to me that the number 5 had a special significance to the Denise society. From the ancient heraldic symbols of the ruling elite to the humble homes of the commoners, it was ubiquitous. Its presence here is obviously a direct reflection of the minds that designed the texts that I used to compose this age. Further proof that, through their art, the Denis masters were indeed creating the marvelous worlds they wrote, and not, as many have mistakenly thought, merely building links to pre-existing worlds. While most of my constructions have been based on Denis design, I see now that the ones that I have imbued with the power of 5 are clearly the most beautiful, the most perfect, and I believe the most structurally sound. I am still attempting to determine how the Denis color symbology reflects this superior design principle. Although superficially it is based on a 6 color system, I am convinced that there has to be a deeper connection to 5. I will continue to investigate. 83.9.11. I've finally made a breakthrough. I have succeeded in modifying the fire marbles to generate enough power to hold a descriptive linking book in a stable matrix. I have linked to a new world. It is a harsh and desolate age, but it is nonetheless well-suited for my purposes, and so I have designated it my 233rd. By studying it closely, I believe I will eventually be able to create a more appropriate age for us to resettle on. For now, I will build an office and set up my living quarters there, in order that I may conduct my experiments in safety and without distraction. I must admit that I am proud of my work. To think that in such primitive conditions, I have accomplished in 29 years what it took the original Denis centuries to achieve. 84.4.13. I have begun construction on a series of link sites for each island that will reconnect Riven with my office on 233. The Survey Guild has finally completed the site location for each island, according to my exact specifications, and installation of the domes is underway at last. Work on the central power source got off to a bit of a bad start, I'm afraid, but the pace has picked up considerably since then, and I anticipate no further delays. I'm looking forward to finally having a civilized mode of transportation. Due to the rebels' continued disturbance, I've decided to install a coded access system into all of the domes. Here is the combination. 85.6.7. I caught one of my assistants looking over this journal today. I'm glad I've chosen to write it in a language they cannot decipher. Note, discuss security with each guildmaster. No problems expected from the maintainers, educators, and surveyors. Question the bookmakers and builders more closely. 86.10.24. Today I heard several more reports of spirit sightings by some of the villagers. It seems that under Catherine's leadership, the rebels, or the Black Moiety, as the villagers obstinately insist on referring to them, have attained a new level of sophistication in their terror tactics and have renewed their campaign to intimidate the villagers into joining them, playing upon their shared superstitions. The villagers are certainly susceptible to this form of coercion, especially given of late the rebels' increasing acts of vandalism and theft. 87.1.15. The Itrim traps have been steadily fruitful this year. Apparently the breakup of the island has not adversely affected the subterranean ecosystem. Unfortunately, I imagine the rebels are experiencing a similarly generous harvest. No shortage of poison for their darts this season. Such morbid issues aside, the sudden availability has allowed me to refine a particularly pleasant extract for my pipe, one that is smoother than any of the others from recent years. 87.3.29. Chemical analysis of one of the rebel knives has yielded curious results. Its composition contains elements that are unlike anything I've encountered on the island. It appears they have access to a resource of which I am unaware. Perhaps a mine or an uncharted island? Note, most of the knives have been found on the south side of the village. This is the same area in which there have been reports of people mysteriously disappearing. I think a closer inspection of that area is warranted. The fact that they leave these distinctive knives as a sign of their presence concerns me. They're growing more bold and seem to no longer fear discovery of their hideout. 87.6.27. The latest measurements indicate that the recent trend has continued. The movements of the island has slowed tremendously. My previous estimates predicted a total collapse in approximately 3 months, but with the new figures, I'm uncertain. I have nearly finished writing the 234th age, and I have every faith that it will indeed be a safe place for us to relocate to. Yet, it would be helpful to know what has caused the halt in this age's breakup. Is it possible that it's stable after all? If so, I must discover how this age differs from my less successful attempts. My examination of the 233rd age thus far have proven inconclusive. Or perhaps someone is repairing the damage to the 5th age? If so, it would almost certainly be Atrus's doing. I have reluctantly decided to abandon my experiments into the behavior of the water of this age, as there are more pressing matters on which I must now concentrate, leaving me with little time for such speculative research. For future reference, however, my investigations up to this point have revealed the following. I believe the remarkable properties of the water to be caused by a life form that resides in it, specifically a type of bacteria. I am imagining a motile unicellular organism, but one with structures capable of holding bits of water whose combined effect, via surface tension or a stronger force, causes the composite body of water to move in response to heat. Prolonged exposure to extreme heat, for example, a period of extended boiling, seems to kill the bacteria, which would explain its dramatic aversions to heat sources. Unfortunately, these theories are still not fully tested, and I remain ignorant of both its deeper nature and its possible uses. 87.7.6. An exciting development. Last night, a squad of maintainers stumbled upon a lone rebel scout and obtained from him a most incredible device. It's a crystal that somehow powers these flawed linking books, much as my own system does, but with an obvious advantage. It is small and weighs only a few pounds, making it completely portable. Catherine must have fabricated the device before I captured her, obviously with an explicit Denise schematic she must have brought with her to this age. If only I had access to such a document after all these years. Regardless, I can now concentrate solely on the writing of ages and need no longer worry about building elaborate power supplies for each new book I write. This is a sobering reminder, however, that I must continue to seek an avenue to Denis. Regaining access to the resources there may be crucial to the completion of my mission. 87.7.28. Last week, while monitoring the situation of the villagers from the scope in my survey room, I observed one of the natives swim out to a small object that appeared to be floating but unanchored near the entrance to the bay. I ordered the object removed from the water for inspection. Several days later, however, I was surprised to see another floating there. The missing object had apparently, and quite mysteriously, been replaced with a new one overnight. I've long been aware of the existence of similar artifacts on the villagers' island, but have paid them little notice until now. Tomorrow I shall send the surveyors to catalog the others. The first thing I noticed was Gen's musings on the stars beneath the fissure, the very phenomenon Atrus suggested I must manipulate to signal him. Gen sealed this fissure shut, but continues to observe its starfield. How? With a telescope, of course. Have I seen a telescope anywhere? The viewing device back on the Temple Island plateau, where I first arrived in Riven. Could that be poised over the star fissure itself? It must be. And the revelations just keep coming. The most telling evidence of Gen's basic nature comes from his primitive method of using an external source, the fire marble domes, to power his crude linking books. These book repositories are stoked in turn by the massive golden dome. It is indeed the central power source I guessed it was. Gen's journal provides a 5-number access code for the slider locks on the fire marble domes. Unfortunately, most of the numbers are greater than 10, so I don't recognize them. But they're composed of similar elements. Perhaps I can extrapolate those numbers from the ones I already know. In another place, Gen has spoken of Denis color symbology, concluding that entry with a 6-symbol sequence, perhaps the same symbols I've been finding on the fire marble domes. He correlated each dome with a color. I must remember to seek further evidence of this. Tramcar station. The view here is panoramic. From just outside Gen's lab, I can see all three of the other main islands, including the connections, tram cables, footbridge, even the logging car tracks rising out of the water tube. The tram below runs directly into a strange three-tiered island, the only one I haven't explored yet. Surely, it holds the key to Gen's whereabouts. All right, and that is going to conclude our reading for today. That is part two of The Prima Strategy Guide to Riven, the sequel to Myst by Rick Barba. Like I said, this was a bonus episode, so it'll be coming out on Friday, and part three will be ready for you on Wednesday of next week. So please look forward to that. I hope you're enjoying it so far. Please send me your feedback about the show, how you're enjoying it so far, or any ideas you have or feedback you might have for me. You can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at @endless_odyssey, and you can tweet at the podcast account at @codex_radio. If you prefer, you can also email the show at codexpodcast@myriadtrues.com. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.